Welcome to Catalytic Curiosity. I am your host, James with a Y O'Farren with Catalytic Conversations. I serve remote professionals and hybrid organizations with coaching, consulting, and training to help them reconcile humanity and technology, leading to healthier, digitally integrated lives and teams. On this podcast, I'm embarking on a journey of discovery to unearth the roots of digital mastery and maturity beyond mere adulting. I interview insightful and intriguing experts, exploring how we can develop sage-like maturity with intention in today's digitized world. Today's episode brings Daniel Hammond to the table to talk about his new book launch, Customer-Driven Leadership. Daniel is a man of many talents that he leverages to serve others in powerful ways. Some of those skills include being an expert interrogation instructor and course developer. He's an expert at four military intelligence disciplines, including cyber threat, and he's a world-class cyber exercise designer, developer, and facilitator. He enjoys collaborating with entrepreneurs, building out new capabilities to help them mitigate the risks and find hidden opportunities on their path to new markets and new revenue. He has a ministry focus serving the people of Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala by looking for and finding solutions for the root cause of irregular migration. Daniel is the co-author of Customer-Driven Leadership Legacy Edition, available on Amazon and its implementation guidebook. He also enjoys collaborating with coaches all over the world. He loves to solve problems and serve people. I met Daniel at Coach Connect, another connection through there, and we have had amazing number of awesome conversations, including this one, where we talk about his journey culminating in this book and all the things that he's learned along the way. So buckle up and join us for an amazing ride. Well, hello and welcome to the Catalytic Curiosity Podcast. Today, I have with me a good friend of mine. We've had a lot of amazing conversations. He's a fellow coach and a fellow member of Coach Connect, which is run by Jared Polak, which was one of my prior guests on here. And I met him through that community, and we really connected on a lot of different topics, a lot of shared values, a lot of shared beliefs about community and the power of growth in community and things we can do to change the world. So I am really excited to have Daniel on here because he has some really cool stuff that's coming down the pipeline, recently launched, and some cool stuff in his background to share with us. So welcome to the podcast, Daniel.
Hey, thank you so much, James. I appreciate it. And you and I really connected right from the get-go.
Oh my goodness.
So many things. So
that first conversation was like 4 hours of conversation packed into one.
It was all good stuff though. Really
good. It was stuff. Really good.
And you're right. I mean, I am so much more interested than spending my time figuring out ways to make the world a better place than pretty much anything else.
So. Yep. Absolutely. So share a little bit of what you've done with that. Like, what are some of the endeavors, action things that you've done in your past and your experience that you've brought you to where you are now with changing the world?
Yeah, well, sure. I think, you know, and let's go going back to when I was younger and mm-hmm. knew far less than I knew now, but probably thought that I knew more than I knew now.
Oh, always.
That's how we all get wiser, right? I just try to do the best job that I could do at whatever I was doing. And, you know, I quickly outgrew roles more quickly than I could get promoted. Typically, I would say that's a fair statement across my career. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of loyalty. So I didn't typically just bail out of organizations when I, you know, tapped out. It was a process of realizing and maybe some nudging from above that got me moving to the next thing. So I started off, I was just an assistant manager to Stop and Go. And then I moved on to become a manager at a Little Caesars Pizza. I was early 20s. Literally went from an assistant manager trainee to a certified training manager in, I don't know, 9 months, something like that. So, there was no room for growth there. I checked all boxes. Nobody was going to promote a 22-year-old to a district supervisor. So, that kind of ended that. So I joined the Army and, I said, what's the hardest thing to qualify for? Cause I really love challenges in life. When I'm bored, I'm not I'm not a good person. Nature. I've pushed buttons. I'm like, what does this do? What would happen if we did this? Let's create the disaster so that I could get a little more entertained with my job, which actually you'll hear is kind of where I ended up. I was about to say,
that sounds familiar. Some of the things that you got into later.
Eventually I got paid for that. I asked, what's the hardest thing? They said, a linguist, a signals intelligence linguist. Mm-hmm. And so I had a couple of options. I could join for 5 or 6 years, get a $5,000 or $6,000 bonus. They give me a language of their choice, or they had a third option, which was a 4-year enlistment, with Spanish as a language and airborne option. So I'd be going to airborne school. So that's what I chose. I thought, you know, being able to speak English and Spanish would basically let me talk to half the world, and really happy with that choice. Turns out that my ability to absorb knowledge does not translate well to languages. I think just the vocabulary that I have and the words that I like to tap into in that vocabulary, when you're reduced to learning a new language, 100 or 500 or 1,000 words, it's just insufficient. And so, and of course I love to play with language. I love to, puns and jokes and, it's fun, and it's hard to do that, much harder to do that in a foreign language.
Sure.
I got better now with 20 plus years of experience and two native Spanish speakers in my immediate family. My Spanish is a little bit better, but I was in the 82nd Airborne Division after a year and a half of training. Got to do a bunch of fun things that, combat lifesaver, and I was the guy that they would send when they didn't know what it was going to take or had no idea how to do it. Mm. And they just knew that I could go figure it out. I typically was on the strange paths, and that's where I like to be. I like to be out figuring out new things again. Got out of the army after a unsuccessful marriage. Had a son that was living in Texas, and I was stuck in North Carolina, and they weren't willing to let me go. And I said, "Well, you can't keep me." So I got out of the army. I went into the Army Reserves. Started going to school. Army Reserves. The day I transferred in, they gave me, they said, "Hey, that position that you just signed up for is gone as of today. Do you want to become an interrogator?" And so I said, "Why, yes, that sounds like fun."
So back to the pushing buttons and breaking things.
I already have the hardest job to qualify. So now let's talk about the most fun job in the military. So went through interrogation school. I break rules wherever I go. So let's just say that some rules were broken, but I won't say which ones. but I jumped through all the hoops that I was supposed to jump through. Was unbelievably good at understanding the system of interrogation and really good at understanding people. And so those two things made me, well, the day they handed me my diploma and said, come be an instructor with us. And so I made the transfer, taught interrogation for 6 years, ended up going to the deploying and doing the job. Mm-hmm. I had a bunch of, I had some military people that I interrogated. I had some scientists. I had some politicians. I had some bankers,
white diversity,
an insurgent or two, but nothing was really particularly challenging for me. And so
did you learn anything in particular from those experiences that you carried over into your coaching and things like that?
I just, everything that I learned, everything that I learned through my life is another tool in my tool belt.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so definitely Yes. It was interesting in that it was a new culture, and I adapted far more quickly, I think, than most of the interrogators. We all, and I know you know this, right? We all carry biases with us wherever we go.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And my ability to see things from other perspectives allows me, I think, to bypass a lot of those biases, right? I'm like,
right.
You know, I'm thinking
step into somebody else's shoes.
Right. You know, it's not the same place. I mean, you know, some of the things in the Middle East that I ran into was, you know, oh, if my kid, if I'm out and I'm driving at night and I run over your child, my tribal leader talks to your tribal leader. They tell me how much to write the check for and we're good. Yeah, that's
a bit different.
Strange, you know, just, I was interrogating people, let's say two generations older than me, and they didn't know the names of anyone my generation. It was always, oh, that is so-and-so's oldest son's second son. You know, they don't even know their name. It's just, it's truly kind of a caste system within the generations.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. And so, that was very interesting to me and a hurdle to overcome, because at the time I was in my 30s. And so I'm interrogating people, you know, in their 60s,
right,
you know, for the most part. And, you know, I wasn't the youngest, for sure of the interrogators, but, so there were interesting things to kind of navigate, through right. that. But I did that extremely well. And, you know, I got to a point where I'm like, well, you know, I really want somebody who I know is a hardened, you know, job, right? So a tough nut to crack. Everything.
What's your hardest kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. And I got that answered, kind of that prayer answered in 48 hours, and I was handed top 10 detainee, and I did everything honorably, and it took me, you know, less than two sessions to have full cooperation, where that person was actively helping me to answer the questions that I had. And
inspiring that kind of collaboration from someone who's from an antithetical perspective is powerful success there.
Yeah. I think so. And to be fair, this is probably something that not a lot of people know, but interrogators, we play with baselines and things of that nature, right? So you can see, you know, this person seems to, you know, have a certain characteristic, right? I saw somebody once, I watched an interrogation for 2 hours and all he did was two things. I don't know. And no, that did never happen. And so, and if you'd fast forwarded it, if it had been recorded and you had fast forwarded it, you would have just seen him go like this. And so all of a sudden they got asked a question and they start stroking their beard and they're like, no, I don't know anything about that. Well, all of a sudden I woke up. I was like, oh, I'm gonna write that question down. Yeah. And so we got done, and at the end they were like, oh, I thought that went really well. And it's like, yeah, there was one question he lied to you on though. And the guy was like, what? And I'm like, yeah, I'll come back and I'll reassess that question and see. And you know, after I got cooperation, I ended up getting a completely different answer. It was, you know, he was hiding information that he didn't want them to have.
But watching, learning their own baseline so that you can then see their deviations from it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And so, but the other key piece that I really learned over there is you can't do it alone. As important, if you want real information, you need to have information to be tested. So an analyst is critical to a good interrogator. They need that analyst so that if I ask questions and I go, here's what they said, somebody's going, yeah, no, that's not true. That's not true. That, yeah, this is good. This is good. This is good. If you don't have that, you're just guessing. And so I found out that I did talk to a guy who was who told me crazy fanciful stories, but I had nothing to cross-reference the accuracy of the statements with. And I found out later that, yeah, that was all garbage.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I didn't. He had 20 some odd years to practice his lies. And so he had him down pretty well. So, you know, it's not like, you know, I'm the perfect interrogator, but, you know, fully equipped and fully resourced. I was really good.
So what was the next step of taking those skills and then moving to your next point in their career? Cause you've used that kind of expertise, not just humans.
Yeah. So next I went and I became a contract interrogation instructor. I started doing that at the basic course. They were trying to push a lot of people through, that creates problems, in standards. And from my perspective, I'm the kind of guy, I don't know. I know you're a fan of assessments. This is an assessment out there, it's called PRINT, and it's your underlying motivations. Uh-huh. And I'm a 1-8. The one is, to do things, and this part does not resonate with me at all, but perfectly, I'm not a perfectionist, but to do things right and correct. And that part is critical to me. I don't compromise on my, on my integrity. So that was one of the things that, it was time for me to move on. And the other one, by the way, 8 is, self-reliant. So,
which is a challenge because you believe so much in community and doing things in connection and collaboration with other people, and having that intention with self-reliance is an interesting dichotomy there.
Yes. It's easy for me to let go of things when I know that somebody wants it and somebody is gifted in that space and can do it. Mm-hmm. It's harder. It's harder for me just to let go of something to let go of something. Right. And I mean, certainly when you have that type of personality and you have the loyalty level that I have, sometimes people will pile things on you heavier and deeper than other people. And again, I mostly like that challenge. So that's one of the things. So I went on after 9 months, I checked all the boxes and at the basic level, and I started looking for something else because it was just, I'm not going to pass somebody who can't do the job. And so I ended up helping to design an advanced interrogation and analysis course, because like I told you, that's a key component of making interrogation successful. And so I helped build that course, design the scenario. That is really one of the areas of giftedness I have, is that the ability to see things from other perspectives allows me to think like a bad guy. And so I could create crazy scenarios. I created a scenario with 80 prisoners, each with little pieces of the puzzle that the interrogator and analysis team would run down, and so that they could get the big picture of, you know, what was going to happen in this big event. And so, you know, that stuff is fun for me. Playing board games and figuring out board games is a hobby of mine. I own 750 board games. So.
Nice.
I don't get to play as much as I used to, but it's still fun. And then
I reached out to you a while back to talk through some of my own like game design ideas, because I know, because you think with, you know, how to break things constructively, and I know you're the guy to bring up, like, here's the idea of how the mechanics of this would work. What are your thoughts on how people could, you know, find loopholes and break the system and all that kind of stuff, because you're the guy for that.
Correct. I instantly min-max everything. I'm like, well, what if this extreme happened or this extreme happened?
All the edge cases.
Yeah, exactly all of those crazy use cases. And so actually I'm accredited in over 10 games for as a play tester, and there was one game that I liked, but there was the early part of the game wasn't well balanced. And so I made a suggestion, and that actually became a core component of the game. Nice. It completely changed the play of the game.
Very cool.
So that was fun. So from there, I quit my job and moved to Honduras to marry my girl. she had a daughter. And then my son came and joined us. So we had, the four of us living life in Honduras. I helped my wife with her textile export company, buying up overstock t-shirts and getting them to the client the way the clients want them. And that was a good job. Then we got home invaded, guns at our kids' heads, give us all your stuff. Not fun. Don't recommend. That ended up, strangely enough, leading to me getting hired to be the general manager of a physical security company with over 400 employees. It was bleeding money. The owner didn't know where. I said, I'll come take a look. I got there and I'm like, this is too big of an organization for me to figure out what's going on unless I have the reins. So I said, I need to be in charge. And so put me in charge, and I found where we were bleeding money and how much hidden debt we had, and triaged the company to at least be, you know, treading water. And then the president of the country raised minimum wage 69.5% overnight. And I was just like, yeah, I can't save you now. There's nothing in the world that's going to save this company. So unfortunately, so, you know, you don't win them all, but I'm the kind of guy that sees the writing on the wall.
Right.
And rather than, you know, him waiting a 2 or 3 months and letting it drag out to where, you know, he would have personal liability, I saw right away, I said, there's nothing that can save you. You need to sign the assets over to the employees so that they can be liquidated and the employees can get paid so that you can be protected. So it's very, once you see what has to happen. Strategic
exit strategy, yeah.
Yeah, once you see what has to happen, I'm the kind of guy that can just say, the hard decisions are easy for me. Let's say that. Yeah. Put it that way. Ended up moving back to the US, started working for a major bank doing cyber threat intelligence. So I kind of learned cyber intelligence on the way in. It took a month for them to do my background checks. For some reason, I was living in a foreign country. That was probably a red flag. Ended up doing that for maybe 3 years. So I went from, again, self-taught to being the lead cyber threat analyst at a global bank.
That was kind of, that probably leveraged a lot of your skills from the interrogation side of things, but applying them into cybersecurity.
Yes. So my specific area of expertise was nation state threat. Mm. And I really looked at nation state actors as personalities. You know, that China's playing the long game, but they'll steal anything that's not nailed down. They'll take any advantage. When you're engaged in something that's going to put you in competition with them, they're hacking your lawyers. They're coming at you every way.
Yeah.
Once you're on their radar, they're gonna find a way. And they've done that with the U.S. government. Getting into the records of people who have security clearances. Yeah, no reason to protect that stuff. Got really good at that, I get bored. I trained my replacement, got bored, started looking and volunteering in the cyber exercise team. I knew how the bad guys think in cyber. And so I started designing realistic scenarios for the cyber exercise team. That opened up a position for me there. I transferred there. I delivered over 60 exercises in 4 years. Anywhere from a team exercise of 3 people. And so a cyber exercise is basically a simulation of a cyber attack, usually a tabletop. So we're talking about what's going on, not necessarily, you know, breaking things and making them fix them, right? But talking about if this was broken, what would you do? Who would you call? And so it's a really good tool for having people take a deep look at what is your current posture? Are you ready for this type of threat? And, you know, what more could you be doing? It lets your responders practice these threats before they show up. So they're not trying to figure it out while under attack. Get to exercise your playbooks, make sure they work, see if there's any gaps in them. And I ended up doing that all the way up to the financial services industry. That this thing behind me, Sheltered Harbor. This is an exercise at the highest level of the U.S. financial services sector. It was okay. An exercise I designed myself, had senior officials, regulators at the state and federal level, White House people, law enforcement, Secret Service, FBI, CEOs, CISOs, and the Secretary of the Treasury dropped in for 30 minutes. And so I facilitated an exercise in front of the Secretary of the Treasury.
Super cool.
Yeah. So really that's, and then eventually the bank that I worked for wanted me to come in to an office not near where I live. And I was like, that's not going to work for me. So I became an entrepreneur, started a consulting business in the cyber exercise space. And still do that. I do a little bit of, I've learned, kind of through the coaching process. So, you know, I joined John Maxwell team, at that point. I, was involved in a lot of masterminds, doing a lot of personal growth. And then I started, I got hired, by another Fortune 500 financial to create a cyber exercise program. I built that for them over a 9-month period. That was giving me the kind of income that let me qualify for strategic coach, which is Dan Sullivan's Who Not How, Gap in the Gain, group, and, really love their tools, in the entrepreneurial space, becoming a better and better entrepreneur every session that I was there, got a lot of clarity on myself. They believe everybody has a unique ability. It's kind of, what do you do better than anyone else? Mm-hmm. And they had some tools there to help me figure out what my unique ability was. And so my unique ability is to quickly adapt and build trust, absorb knowledge, discern connections, optimize strategies, overcome problems, and positively influence outcomes in order to maximize success, to protect against risk, to oppose evil and injustice, and to fight for what's right and true.
Love it.
And so that clarity kind of led me into my wife and I volunteered to build a nursing school. And that was in 2015, way before all this happened. We said yes before we knew how we would possibly raise what we thought would be maybe $50,000. James, so much money. And we just kept getting amazing partners brought our way until we had just the right team. We had a lot of people both in the US and locally step up and really deliver. And we ended up raising $235,000 and built a modern nursing school and clinic in this little town in central Honduras.
Super cool.
Yeah, that led to the Bishop of Honduras, the Episcopal Bishop of Honduras. The program was started by an Episcopal priest. So we got involved with the Bishop. Mm-hmm. He was on board. And so he invited his peers from El Salvador and Guatemala. And we were working with an organizational psychologist named Ted Anders, Dr. Ted Anders. Mm-hmm. And he kind of led us through a strategic visioning, right? How can we serve you next? And mm-hmm. the bishops agreed our biggest problem is people leaving the country. They're, you know, abandoning their families. They're getting a lot of debt to a lot of bad people. Mm-hmm. The conditions that make people want to leave are toxic to, a good life here. Yeah. So there's a lot of push pull in that. Mm-hmm. And so we committed Ted and I and the bishops to work on those problems over the next 10 years. By dealing with the root causes of what's causing people to want to leave. And so that's sort of leading up to what I'm doing now. We're at a place where, without resources, you can only do so much. Things take some money. And so, working with Ted, with the bishops really let me see kind of his unique ability. And so I said, Ted, man, your programs with the bishops were just brilliant. I really, really love those. You know, what else do you have? I want to see how you work. And I know you were a consultant in corporate America. Mm-hmm. I want to see some of those things. And I go, man, I just want to see it. I will pay to see that. And so he said, come to Florida, take a look at I'll walk you through my programs. You tell me what you think. James, if I have a superpower, it's that I can break anything. And I used to say I break things for good.
Yeah.
I try to, and that's what I was doing with exercises, right? I was, creating these disaster scenarios to make these executives freak out, to really take the problems they had. They already had the problems. They just didn't know they had the problems.
Right.
And so then they can focus better and take care of the things that were important.
Yeah.
Ted's programs are amazing. He's got a lot of wide variety there. But the one that he showed me that I just, fell in love with, I guess is a good term, as good a term as any, it's customer driven leadership.
Right.
And
which brings us.
Yeah. So he showed me this thing and I'm looking at it and I'm like, I know how to jam some stuff in the spokes of this thing, but it's self-healing and self-correcting.
That is so powerful.
Yeah, that's huge.
That's gold.
You can fail customer-driven leadership, but customer-driven leadership isn't going to fail you. Hmm. And that is like a perpetual motion machine. That thing that just, it's the alchemist formula to turn lead into gold. It just you can't really find it very easily.
No. So,
The hardest part for me is it's so hard to sell customer-driven leadership. It's like trying to sell snake oil. It does that. It does this, and it does that. it fixes everything. But what's amazing about it is wherever you're struggling, it's going to tighten that up. It's the 1% growth a day, until it uses monthly assessments. So. When I told Ted, I was like, wow, this is it, Ted. This is we need to be doing this. Ted said, co-author the second edition with me. Wow, that led to quite the journey.
How long ago was that?
That was in December. So I found an author or a company that would help me because I've never been an author. I wanted a who for that, right? So. Yeah. In my strategic coach group, the original group, I had 10x'd by this time. So I was kind of up at the next level. Mm-hmm. But, we had talked about this before. And really fantastic experience, really great team members helping me along the way, learned a lot. But so made the decision to do it in December, started really on it in January of this year. Mm-hmm. And with the thought that we would consult, Ted and I would go around he did this. This program has been around since the mid 90s. It is literally 100x'd businesses, taking $10 million businesses to $1 billion businesses. It's
wow.
It's gone into worst in class bureaucratic organizations and crank them up to a level of efficiency where they were just crushing every other, for a bureaucracy to ask for help. They've got
I was about to say, that's a miracle.
Right. I would say the thing that's closest to CDL that I know of is EOS, which is the Entrepreneurial Operating System. Customer-driven leadership tightens up the people and gives them ownership of the processes and a defined what Ted calls a playing field. This is the area, don't cross this line without coming to get help. But if you don't define the playing field, it doesn't mean they're not on the playing field. It just means they're probably going to stand in the middle because they don't know where the edge is, right? And right, so right. By clearly defining what they have the power to take care of themselves, means that you're not getting bothered by their problems every day. They're solving them themselves.
They're empowered to be able to take charge of things that they were given responsibility for.
I couldn't have said it better myself, James. Yeah, and what's different too, when I was in the corporate world, and to a lesser extent, the military, you're jockeying for a gold star, right? There's only so many gold stars.
Yeah.
Not everybody's going to get them. Mm-hmm. You're a team of 10, maybe one, two people are going to get a attaboy that's worth it in compensation and stuff. Customer-driven leadership doesn't work that way. Its incentive programs are about, look, your team, team A, serves team B to serve the end user, right? The client, the external client. And it's like, what does team B need from team A to serve the client? and it goes all the way down, right? I mean, it's probably A through, you know, T or whatever, however many teams there are. And there are some teams that serve everybody, like HR in a company that serve all the teams, right? Their job is to keep people with people.
Yeah.
Make sure those people are well-trained and ready to do their jobs.
Yep.
When you start building that out and you start saying, okay, what's the most important thing my team needs to deliver to your team? Then that team is held accountable to that. And so wherever they are at the start of CDL is kind of like a 25%, you know, and their goal is get to 100%. And you, the closer you get to 100%, the more money we will pay you, because really you're increasing how well the business does business or the organization serves its clients, because it works with nonprofits too, right? It might not be a paying client, but still, would you rather, you know, feed 100,000 kids, or would you rather get 20% more effective so you can feed 120,000 kids, whatever it is, right? Being more effective and serving better is better. So the largest part of the bonus structure is about how is a team score. So if you and I are on the same team, we're not competing against each other for the gold star.
This is so powerful and critical. Going back to like game theory.
Oh
like,
my gosh.
We talk about like gamification of things like, oh, I put a leaderboard up. Like, no.
Yes, yeah.
You have the worst things you can do.
right. And you could be a superstar, but if you know you're number three and you're never going to knock one and two out, you're just as zero like everybody else, right?
And then people at the bottom are just like, why should I even try?
Why should I even try?
But if it's the team
trying
to grow, then everybody's contributing and everybody's motivated to contribute. Yes, it is powerful.
And let's look at it from a perspective, right? Let's say it's you, me, and one other person, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a job none of us on the team likes to do.
Yep.
Now you start negotiating. Okay, well, somebody's got to do this or our team's going to suffer. We're not going to get a good score. Yep. So, you know, I'll do it on day one. You do it on day two. You know, we'll have a rotation.
Right.
I'll take care of it 1 week. You take care of it the next week, whatever it is. Right. Or maybe it's the one task that like Daniel's like, oh man, I love that. I do that all day. Great. I take that task for the team and the people who hate it don't have to ever do it.
Right.
Except for maybe when I go on vacation and I'll leave some good notes for them.
Right.
But that's important.
It reframes it. It creates collaboration.
And you start finding where each other's strengths are and you lean into each other's strengths instead of everybody just kind of, you know, fumbling. I mean, I like to say, look, you're in a widget job, right? And your job is to inspect the widget, put the widget in the bag, put it back on the conveyor belt. It moves along, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you get to a place where all of a sudden the widgets stop coming down the conveyor belt. In a normal job, what's going to happen?
I don't have to work.
I just stand here until the widgets come, right?
Right.
My job is to inspect the widgets. There are no widgets. My job is done. I'm doing my job.
I go read a book.
Right. I can do whatever. I can, whatever it is, I'm done. But if we have a deliverable to deliver a certain number of widgets to the next team,
and that's across the
entire now team. All of a sudden, the widgets not coming down is a problem for the team. And so it's okay. Who's going to go check and see what's going on with the widgets? The widget delivery system is broken. We need widgets or else we'll fail. That changes everything.
Yeah.
And so nothing falls through the cracks. It's you're just, and you know, as you tighten up, let's say you focus on the one biggest thing, then you start going, okay, we've got this. Now let's add the next two most important things and the next most important thing, or go, oh, we've gotten this good. What if we move it over and try to get even a little better and a little better and a little better? And it's not to like, you know, oh, well, if we make it harder for them, then we'll have to pay them less bonus, right? It's about, you know, okay, you guys have gotten this 3, 4, 5 months in a row. You're hitting 100 every time.
Yeah.
And we need to go. We're going to see if we can stretch you a little bit more, you know, and see how.
Awesome.
Yeah. So it's very positive. It builds culture. The whole thing is aligned. What is the vision of the organization? What do they want to accomplish? And what are its values? Right. So those are part of the playing field definitions, right? And so you can tell somebody, hey, you know, the way you dismiss that customer, that doesn't align with our values.
Right.
And so as a team,
It empowers positive conflict.
Correct. Yep. I love that. That is such a, I love talking to you, James. You get it, man. You get it.
I love it. I'm looking forward to reading this book. Do I get a signed copy?
Yes, for sure. For sure. So in that kind of, we call them customer careabouts. That's how you deliver to the next team and how you eventually deliver to the external client.
Yep.
But within the organization, there are also community careabouts. Are we reflecting our values and are we delivering for our team? Yeah. And so, you know, within the team, we get to kind of give each other a score. And it's not like, yeah, James, he's a 3-star out of 5-star employee. It's does James continually reflect the values of our organization, right?
And if specific, not, like specific, not just specific. Not just a blank stars, but like specific actionable feedback.
Correct.
Yes.
Where have you seen James not reflect our values?
In action. Yes.
Exactly.
Specific examples.
So that we can tell James, hey, when you treat a customer this way, it reflects poorly on the organization.
Yep.
And so James now knows what he has to do to bump up to the next level.
Yes.
Right. And truly, there are some people who are never going to reflect the organization's values. And, you know, obviously we're coaches, so you're going to try to coach them up. You're going to try and get them the training. And then from there you go, okay, you're not a good fit for the organization, or maybe you're not a good fit for this team.
Right.
If it's a values problem, it's probably not a good fit for the organization. Right. But if it's a productivity problem, maybe it's, you're not a good fit for this team.
Yeah.
Maybe it should be off the widget inspection team. and think about it. You know, you and I are not going to want that third person dragging us down in the stats every month, right? And so
you want him to be in a place where he can actively serve. Yeah.
And the leaders of the organization, every month when the company is assessed, sees which team is doing the worst. Mm-hmm. And they can come together and go, hey, entire organization, what can we do to help this team? Not let's fire them, or, you know, it's like, let's come together and brainstorm. What is it? Oh, you're 2 people short.
Well,
you need 4 people. That's fixable. Let's resource this team so that they can get where they need to be. Right. And so those conversations are happening every month. And so, it's amazing.
It was timely as well. That's awesome.
Yeah. And the one thing that I will say, that's very interesting about, and this is sort of I did a kind of a TEDx style talk in front of some friends in Colorado in April. And I called it Build Good Things. And I really think, you know, as a coach, you know, right, you coach the individuals, right? Yep. You get them to get over their problems and limitations. Mm-hmm. And then you look at, okay, well, then now that our people are leveled up, what's the next step? Well, let's make them a better team, right? Let's get the team working.
How do you coach a culture?
Yeah, you can use DISC or Colby or anything like that, where they start to understand strength finders, right? Oh, there's a problem. Bring it to Daniel. He loves problems all day long. Don't bring him widgets. Bring him problems. So then you kind of up-level that team, and you get to where Ted has high-performing teams. And that's really where customer-driven leadership begins. If you haven't invested in your people and you haven't invested in your teams, this is not going to work for you. I mean, it's like putting jet fuel in a, you know, 40-year-old beater. You know, it's going to be a disaster. It's not, even if it pushes you fast, you're going to fall to pieces real quick. And so it is really you know, we need good strategic partnerships with coaches.
Right.
And the thing that, you know, Ted used to go in when he was doing it all, you know, he would go in and he'd do that individual coaching, the team coaching, and then he'd build the CDL on top of that. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for a model more where we work with coaches that are already working with organizations. And once they've run out of things where they're like, hey, you know, I would love to keep helping you, but, you know, we need an organizational transformation model. And I know a team that does that.
There you go.
And then we have a partnership with you, right? And, and we do an assessment and it's going to tell me, hey, team A, they're not ready for innovation. Their innovation ability to innovate is too low. And then James can go in and give them, you know, a class on how to do creative thinking and how to, you know what I'm saying?
How to brainstorm effectively, et cetera. Yeah.
Correctly. Yeah. All of that stuff starts to fall into place. And so then we start to partner where
I love that. You
know, we bring those coaches extra income and then they help us get that organization ready for CDL. And then the other big thing is obviously for something that's this hard, you need buy-in at the top. So
absolutely,
you know, you can't,
you need to be able to champion it.
Exactly. And you can't just say, oh yeah, this is the new thing we're installing. And yeah, just do what these guys tell you. That's not going to work.
That doesn't work. No.
Well, and it inverts the hierarchy of the organization. So the CEO or the leader of the organization is on the bottom.
Right.
And everyone in the organization gets to rate them.
Nice.
Instead of the team leader telling the team how they do, the team is evaluated by the teams they serve.
Right.
And they evaluate the leader.
Right.
How well did you equip us to be successful at delivering for the teams that we serve?
I love that. Love that. So this book released on just this Monday or last week?
It was released yesterday.
Yesterday,
I managed to get a copy on Sunday. I was
I saw your YouTube, your Facebook post about that. So, that was so cool.
Yeah, the delivery guy, when I just so happened that I walked out as it was being delivered and I met the guy at my driveway and said, "You are delivering the first copy of my first book that I've ever written." And he's
Which is so powerful.
Yeah. Can I see it? He's like, "Sign it for me." And he's like, "Can I see it?"
Yeah.
I'm standing in the rain and I'm like, "Okay, but let me jump in the Prime delivery van here with you and I'll open it up and I'll show him." And he's like, "Can I take a picture?" And I'm like, "Yeah, you can take
a picture." That's so cool.
It's just a meaningful story. And I appreciate that he took the time. I mean, his time is money, right? I mean, he's getting paid to deliver as fast as he can and taking that time, you know, that 2 or 3 extra minutes.
He did that extra special.
It was
so super cool. So
it speaks to customer driven leadership.
Right? It does. Yeah. So out of this book, what would you call out as one particular action point that it would be most helpful for remote workers, hybrid companies, distributed companies? We've got people working multiple locations, staying in touch online. People are in digital environments. What would be a key takeaway for them from this book?
Yeah. So what I like about customer-driven leadership is it translates virtually very well, right? So it wouldn't matter if you and I are in an office together on the same team.
Mm-hmm.
It's that we need to know, what are we being graded against? Where are we empowered to solve our own problems? Mm-hmm. What do we need to escalate to leadership to get approval to solve, right? Mm-hmm. If we can't break the budget, just, you know, we have to stay within the rules. We can't obviously break any regulatory requirements or anything like that. So, you know, but once you have clarity, you can, like Ted says, you can play right up to the edge of the playing field when you have that field clearly defined.
Right.
And when you get there and you still haven't solved the problem, then you know, hey, I need somebody else. I need leadership to give me an approval to do this or to do that so that I can make this customer happy.
It makes people more able to be autonomous and yet still thoroughly authentically linked to the culture of the company, which is critical for people working remotely.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I just see, you know, as a team, like I said, it doesn't matter where we're sitting. If we all are working under the same operating system, we're all getting the same grade, you know, there's got to be a way. You know, let's say we're doing, let's say we're taking support calls, for example. I mean, tell me one support call place that doesn't record it for quality assurance, right? I mean, if you need to get the feedback of, is Daniel really addressing every customer? You know, you can listen to 5 random things, make sure Daniel's checking his boxes, right?
Yeah.
Or you can count the number of complaints against Daniel.
Yep.
And are they legitimate or not? Because not every complaint is legitimate. I mean,
for sure.
I can't retroactively go back in time and change what you actually ordered into what you thought you ordered.
Right.
but we still want you to leave happy.
Yep.
And so, you know, did Daniel follow our values and our procedures to do his best to take care of this person? Mm-hmm. Did he, I mean, how many times do you feel the resistance when you're like, you can't solve my problem. I want to talk to your boss.
Right.
And they start to resist you, right? Like they know that And so that's not a way to take care of customers. When you can't handle, when you can't serve them anymore, hand them off.
Yeah.
Until they get to somebody who can say, look, I would love to help you. We can't help you. And this is why, or whatever it is. But you know, there's gotta be that kind of stuff in place. And so that's the culture part. Right. And
that was actually, that brings to mind an illustration from my wife, actually, who used to work at overstock.com, which if anybody out there is looking for a job as a, customer care consultant, a help desk person. Overstock is one of the best ones. They actually do a really good job. They have very low turnover compared to like everybody else. But one of the things that they do is that they empower the frontline people on the phones. They clearly define the playing field of what they can do to actually help people. They're not just there to say no and escalate. They're there to actually help the customers. They have time to talk with them. If all they need is a listening ear, they have, you know, access to be able to give refunds and do all these things. They have a lot of freedom to actually help people and a lot of clear delineation. So it's a lot easier for them to actually do that. So this as an example of customer driven leadership there, actually. So that's super cool.
Yeah. And I will tell you what's great is, you know, this system is so well created, but, even without this system, you know the companies that are doing it right.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I work, so I told you I get coached at Strategic Coach.
Yeah.
The average length of employment at Strategic Coach is like 20 years. I mean, they're just
they're doing something right.
And I will tell you the Ted's first customer for customer driven leadership from 1995, still running it today. He is the head of the company, and all he does is look at what new market are we going after. He has over 300 employees, and he told me I talked to him for 3.5 hours, kind of as I was exploring this opportunity with Ted. And he told me over a 20-year period, I had 5 employees quit to go work someplace else. Wow. Because they'll retire, they'll die, but nobody wants to leave here. I mean, awesome. it's so rare.
That is so cool.
And honestly, there would be more customer driven leadership companies, but they become so successful, they become acquired. And then of course the big culture eats the little culture and it works. So I was like, you just killed the soul of the thing that was providing all the excellence that you just bought.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah. But
well, thank you so much, Daniel. This has been absolutely amazing. I love hearing your story and all the things that you've been involved in and how it kind of culminated for now in this particular success of getting your first book published. I will be putting links and everything like that in the show notes for people checking out and getting his book, obviously, and checking all these things out. But thank you so much for being on here and sharing some of these insights. It's been, as always, awesome conversing with you.
Thank you so much for making the world a better place, James. And again, really, really excited for customer driven leadership and looking forward to connecting with coaches who want to know more about it and companies and organizations, nonprofits. I think startups could really use
absolutely
this at the beginning.
Putting it in right from the foundation, right from the get go, would be so powerful.
Yep.
Beautiful. I'd love to see that. All right. I'll be looking forward to my copy. All right. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Take care. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. I hope you had your curiosity sparked to explore these subjects with greater awareness or gained a valuable insight along the way. Take a look at the show notes for links for how you can find out more and connect with Daniel, and also about how you can get the book. Leave reviews wherever you can for the book and for the podcast, and make sure to join the conversation on my Discord. And remember, community is the catalyst that drives lasting transformation. I'll see you in the next episode of Catalytic Curiosity.